Hello and welcome to the last of EG's virtual MIPIM sessions. It's been quite a week. We've been blown away by the way these sessions have been embraced. So thank you for tuning in, and thanks to our partners and speakers for making it all possible as well. We really couldn't have done it without you, and it's been the making of the EG studio here in London. For this last session, we're looking at the future of hotels in the city. These are challenging times for many of us, undoubtedly, and they're likely to get harder still in the short term. For the leisure market, they're especially tough and getting tougher. Hotel groups like Accor are warning that travel and leisure markets have declined very significantly in the last month due to COVID-19. And don't underestimate the importance of this market to the economy as well, the UK economy. Since 2010, tourism has been the fastest growing sector in the UK in employment terms, and Britain is forecast to have a tourism industry worth over £257 billion by 2025, growing throughout that period, faster than the UK economy itself, and much faster than sectors like manufacturing, retail, and indeed construction. No wonder the Chancellor drew attention yesterday to the importance of the leisure economy when he announced targeted business rate reductions. So today we're focusing on the future of visitor accommodation and its role in the city, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Jonathan Manns, Board Director and Head of Planning and Development at Rockwell, James Mitchell, Partner at Axiom Architects, Richard Blythe, Head of Policy at the RTPI, and Tony Mulhall, Associate Director of the Land and Professional Group at RICS. So if I can ask each of you, and perhaps I'll start with you, James. I just wonder what the situation is. You know, we're sat here in London. There are challenges on the horizon. Yet we're talking about a sector that is, has some good growth potential, good growth prospects. Is this a short-term blip? Or is the long-term future still as rosy?
Well, a month ago we'd be sat here, very excited, optimistic, and the growth is really exciting and interesting. Where we sit today, clearly I think there's going to be some challenges over the next few months. I mean, you can't ignore the fact that hotel stay is likely to go down to, looking at the major operators are looking at 90% occupancy normally in London. And I think that's probably going to be looking at sort of 30%. I'm ever the optimist, so I think it is a short-term blip. But it's just a reflection on how interconnected the global markets are, and I think you try and move with the markets effectively. So yeah, I think it is a blip, but who knows? Every day is changing, isn't it? So.
And Jonathan, there is that tension between the short term and the medium term, and there could be quite an impact in the near term.
I think it's a short term blip. Straight up, I think we can still be quite excited and optimistic. The fundamentals are there. People are still looking at leases of 30 years or more often. What you can't avoid is the fact that humans will want to travel, whether it's for leisure or for work or for some other reason to visit relatives. You're never going to get around that. And whilst there might be a need to restrict that travel in the short term, I just don't see that having a long term impact on the sector.
And in terms of your clients, that's a message that you're getting back. Richard, I don't want to dwell on this as a topic, and I think I've probably started each of the sessions that I've chaired in here with this as a topic, but there's no getting away from it. How do you see the near-term horizons? There have been warnings coming from Accor, Hilton and others.
Well, there's not only the current public health crisis, there's also this question of the use of what you might call proper residential accommodation for overnight stays. And something that is of concern to many city governments around the world, e.g. Edinburgh, for example, Dublin, is use of flats for what you could call traditional hotel purposes. So I think a long-term trend could be, will cities increasingly exercise their muscle to say, hang on, these homes are homes, in which case that should be better for particularly maybe the business and economy kind of new bed spaces. Don't suppose it would be particularly relevant for the high end, but that frontier between the use of residential accommodation for what is it, for short term lets, I think we need to resolve that question in the long term. Even after we've resolved the question of public health.
And do you think the two could come together in the sense that it was possibly a can that could be kicked down the road before, how you deal with flats being used to replace hotel rooms, hotel stays? This public health issue may focus minds on addressing it.
Thinking out loud, I suppose there is a question of, are Airbnb kind of lets a public health risk? I'm not an expert as to sort of evaluate that question, or are they actually safer than traditional hotels?
Okay, we shall come back. I'll leave you to ruminate on that for a little bit, and we'll come back to that. And Tony, in terms of the conversations that you're having currently and the impact of this public health issue becoming, you know, perhaps moving towards crisis, the impact that that's having on the conversations you're having with members who are operating in and around the hotels and leisure sector, is it a serious concern?
I think it is, but I think it's probably short term, and I think that's why we need to look at sort of the fundamental difference that occurs as a result of the coronavirus and the sort of underlying trends relating to what people want in hotel accommodation. And there are a lot of participants in this, from the funders, from the operators, and crucially from the sort of the person who actually books a hotel room. What are these people looking for? And where are they looking for it? And then, to go back to Richard's comments, there is the regulatory issue of accommodation. Who is the accommodation primarily for in our cities? And, you know, there have been plenty of examples, like Barcelona, which has been controlling the growth of hotels for a long time, is increasingly sort of careful about, you know, the growth of tourism. And, you know, we at one extreme have cities that have this huge challenge that they're trying to fight off. They have too many tourists. And then we have lots of places around the UK who don't have enough people in them. So at what point can we, is there a capability in this sector to regenerate some of the places that have declined? You know, and how do you link that resource? How do you make that combine effectively? For instance, Margate, traditionally a holiday destination, now has some kind of cultural offer. Well, surely they must need some hotels in an environment like that. And how do you sort of begin locking all of these bits together? Because that's what will be required in order to sort of generate the sort of the end user demand, the investor interest, the security for the investor, the comfort for the operator. And of course, people like Jonathan would then have the confidence to go ahead and develop them.
That's a really interesting point that I'd like to develop in a moment. But James, you wanted to come in there, I think.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree, actually. I think one of our clients, Whitbread, they're actually doing exactly that. They're looking to old sort of seaside resorts and looking at places like Margate. Historically, I think in Victorian times, Margate was like the most visited destination as a seaside resort. Globalization has obviously enabled cheap travel to be able to visit all these cities. But I think you're right. I think hotels are brilliant enablers for towns. I think that's one of the fundamental reasons for good short stay accommodation.
Richard?
Well, it's a common question, isn't it? It's the same with the housing debate. You know, people want to be where there's lots of other people, and can we encourage them to go to where there aren't so many people? Is it a question that traditional seaside resorts can recover the flair that they once had, or is it simply that if people are faced between the choice of going to one of those or not going anywhere, they don't go at all? And that's a very difficult call. Margate has a particular reason why it's now a cultural centre. That happened partly in an unpredictable way. We don't know whether it would happen, say, for Bridlington in exactly the same way. It depends on personalities and what arises.
Okay. And Jonathan, you rightly pointed out that there is a desire to travel, a desire to gather, which will continue. I hope you can hear me okay. But to Tony's point, is that growth in tourism sustainable? And what is a short-term blip at the moment, let's hope, is that going to cause cities to question whether they can and want to maintain the levels of growth that we've seen?
I think that's a fair point. I think, and certainly, as Tony mentioned, Barcelona's facing challenges alongside places like San Francisco as well, but not least around Airbnb and the and uh, the extent to which tourism has placed pressure on traditional residential homes, as Richard has alluded to, but also resulted in the specialisation of the labour force and created a carry cost for local infrastructure services, servicing, policing and so forth. So there are things that need to be mitigated against. I think allied with that, there's also a question around the type of product that people want, because when we're talking around places like Margate, you know, I've only been there for the day, but it struck me there were quite a lot of B&B facilities, which are quite traditional. They offer a very different type of service to what a modern operator would provide. And certainly changes in guest expectation and behaviour are shifting the market, creating to an extent a downward pressure on room sizes. So we're seeing an increasing prioritisation amongst many guests for consistent, good quality products that are well located over room sizes. And we're also seeing, I think, as well, a preference for more personalised experiences, which is reshaping the nature of the uses, what would historically be ancillary uses within visitor accommodation. So when you look at things like gyms and ground floor bars, you know, they are increasingly more outward looking and offering more to the city and as part of a city rather than offering something to the guests within that accommodation. So I think there's an opportunity there as well. So I've probably grazed across a number of issues there, but there are a number of points, I suppose, that we could take from that.
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, it's this requirement or desire for some kind of a unique experience, and whether or not that's actually part of the commercial offering of the hotel is an interesting point, because what a lot of people do when they want that experience of the location, they use the hotel, but then they seek to satisfy that in the areas around. So it's a question then of whether or not the hotel offer is internalizing some of the benefits that were actually in the city, almost in the same way that large shopping centres internalize what a city used to offer. So do you bring them all in-house and offer that experience? I'm not sure that will actually satisfy a certain number of the cohorts. And of course, there is a danger that we see the hotel clientele as a very uniform group, when in fact it's quite a diverse group.
Broader than ever, do you think?
Well, absolutely, and fragmented in the sense of, if you look at what sort of go in decades, the different requirements for those groups, which then takes us to the question from a designer's point of view, is how do you make these hotels adaptable? Because we go through fashions and fads in what we do. And so adaptability of the hotel becomes the form in which you're talking about reducing sizes of bedrooms. Well, suppose the demand comes for larger bedrooms. Are we going to end up knocking together two bedrooms? You know, so how do we have this built-in resilience into the hotel design? Because, you know, we can be pretty sure taste will change.
Okay, Richard, and then I'll bring in Jonathan.
I'm glad you raised that question of resilience, Tony, because another issue that is of great concern to the RTPI is this whole question of things like the embedded carbon in buildings. And in many sectors, but in this one also, there's this question of not the frontier between refurbishing something and building something new. And, you know, what does that mean in terms of our responsibilities to the planet? But also, I think another point Tony made was about the niche market. So some people will pay a premium to be in somewhere with a heritage brand, you know, stay in the hotel that so-and-so stayed in 100 years ago and pay additionally more for that. That's something that's quite difficult to reproduce in a new building. Other people may be happy to have a building that was finished last year and very to be reassured about exactly what they're going to get and a brand loyalty. But there's a balance then between how much this is about repurposing and rebuilding existing buildings and what people want from them, and how much is it about constructing new hotels.
That will always have been the case though, Jonathan, wouldn't
it? Well, I mean, not necessarily. I think to put a bit of historical context on it, I mean, The United Nations World Tourism Organization has identified a growth of about 5,200% in global tourism numbers in the second half and sort of first bit of the second half of the 20th century and first few years of the 21st.
5,200.
5,200% increase, and that was to 2018. We've since then seen another 200 million tourists a year. So as of January this year, there were 1.5 billion tourists globally, and part of that, and there are different drivers for that, and that's impacting on the products that people are looking for. So one driver is obviously, if you look in a global context, the changing affluence and openness of some nations. So between 2001 and 2018, there was an increase in Chinese nationals traveling globally of about 1,300%, now it's around 150 million per year. So there's a whole changing requirements for a particular sector of that market. But there's also the rise in cheap airfare from the 1990s onwards. The city break, for example, which has impacted Barcelona, is a relatively new phenomenon. Yeah. That was developed, you know, really from the 90s, or expanded from the 1990s onwards. And that's driving demand. So I think what it's most important to recognise is that, if anything, we need increasing flexibility in the way that we look at the product to meet an increasingly varied demand.
I think that's right. And I think what we're looking at now, we did a research study actually in conjunction with Rockwell at the NLA, and it was called Nomad City. And it was an exploration about looking at the way people live ever increasingly nomadic lives. And ultimately, we're always going to be social animals. I think everyone wants to kind of socialise. But it's going back to your point earlier about the Airbnb phenomenon. What people actually want is authenticity. So if you look at the hotel rooms, that's generally driven by dwell time. So the hotel room itself can be 11 or 12 metres squared because your dwell time in the room is less. Your time in the city is generally quite longer. So that enables the hotel. And as you say, they just want a clean bed for the night, good technology, well connected, great location. You're out into the city. You won't eat in the hotel. You'll eat in the city, and then you're back just to watch a film or go to bed. So,
what about Tony's point there, though, that may be the case today, but as tastes have changed from 10 years ago, they may be different in 10 years' time. So, how resilient is a modern hotel to adapting to that change in taste?
I think that there's still, we're talking, I mean, that's one particular type. I think what we're seeing is the star system is eroding. I don't think we look at hotels in a star rating anymore. It's generally about whether you have a family size room, which goes up to 21 meters squared, so that fits, you know, three or four people in. You can actually have rooms or suites which have interconnecting doors. So I still think that's there. And it's not necessarily staying in a Hilton or a four or five star hotel. So I think there is just increasingly, I think there's, you sort of look at compact, lower mid-scale, upper mid-scale, lifestyle brands. I mean, they call hotels lifestyle brands now. You know, you're not saying, oh, I'll go and stay in a four star hotel. It's actually about, say, Citizen M, for example, you feel like you're part of a community. So you kind of get given an iPad as you go in. You know, it's got all the links to what you can do locally. It's kind of very kind of, you can work there for the day. You know, a lot of these hotels now on the ground floor area actually are becoming sort of a sort of shared workspace. So going back to your point about how do you adapt those hotels, I think they're still there. It's just, we probably just got to be careful in terms from a planning perspective whether you actually put, how do you police that, I guess, is the question.
I think there's a real challenge in terms of how you, if you take a strategic planning perspective, how do you plan for, monitor and manage a product where traditional lines are increasingly blurred, and where the relationship between what is ancillary and what is outward facing is increasingly blurred. I think it's and this is where you come onto things. I mean, not to get too sort of too planner-acky, but we look at things like the use classes order, and this sort of obsession that we've got as professionals with liking to compartmentalize everything, and that process of compartmentalization becomes much more difficult when you look at things which are less easily defined. And we see it already with co-living and co-working and how you start to think about those relationships. Well, actually, hotels, I think what the point that James is making is hotels aren't immune from, and visitor accommodation isn't immune from that. When we look at shorter service apartments or Airbnb or whatever it might be, it's part of that same transition towards a blurring of traditional boundaries. And so how you actually oversee and manage the delivery of that becomes a question.
So anyone who's been tuning in this week will know that all of our panels have been fluid, and you know, some people have moved onto screens and some people have been unable to make it. And unfortunately, Claire Camplison from Colliers Hospitality Asset Management team couldn't be with us today. So Tony, I'll come to you. It might have been a question I'd have put to Claire, but I'll put it to you that there is this blurring, isn't there, that hotels are competing with residential accommodation through Airbnb. In a Citizens M case, is perhaps competing or overlapping with a serviced office down the road. The restaurants in hotels and you know, standalone restaurants in the city are competing. Do you think that those fairly profound changes are widely recognised enough, whether it's within the planning system or whether it's within the among the operators themselves?
I think they're recognised. Whether they're addressed is the other point. And I go back to
yes to recognise, no to address.
Yeah, I go back to where we started in terms of the visitor experience. And of course, everyone will say, I want the authentic experience of visiting this place. But what does that mean? And, you know, there are various superficial levels of depth that people can have over a 2-3 day period. So I've often wondered, is an add-on service of a hotel in some way to be able to connect people who visit in a short period of time into a network that lets them get a little bit deeper under the skin of the city? Because, you know, this is now a mature market. These are experienced city visitors. And, you know, they just don't want to turn up and see the same three bars, the same church, the same, you know, it's just a different one than the one they were in last week, which was in another city. And I'm sure there's a point where people want to say to themselves, I really would like to know how this city works and why it's the way it is and why the people are the way they are. And how do you actually access that? You know, as a provider of accommodation, tourist accommodation, because when you ask people what they want the authentic experience. But what is this authentic experience? And what does it compare with? Because it seems to me that people are leaving an almost totally virtual experience in their domestic lives, because they're connected into the virtual world almost 24/7, and suddenly they arrive at this destination looking for the authentic experience. So in a sense, there's you know, almost a schizophrenic requirement to get to understand the city and have more of a deeper understanding of the city, probably in a way they don't even understand their own cities.
And that's acknowledged but not addressed. And who needs to address it?
Well,
the operator, the planners?
It's acknowledged. I mean, if you listen to what the user, the person who books the hotel, the person who travels to that city, that's what they keep saying. I want a genuine, real understanding of what's going on here. And by the time that person has visited 10 of these cities, it's the same experience, because they don't have time to get any deeper, you know, than 3 days or 2 days in any city will allow you. So then the question I would have is, how do you actually connect? Is there a way in which hoteliers or people who provide these accommodation services can give access or direct people to where they can get a deeper engagement with the city, and then a better understanding and a more responsible approach to how we occupy other people's cities?
Okay, Richard, I'm not sure what point you wanted to respond to there. There were several.
This is a great point, because it, you know, I understood that when things like Airbnb first came out, the idea was that it was something about you go and stay with somebody in another city, and you know, as their guest, and you pay them something, but you kind of, you know, you eat with them, and it's like a kind of temporary house share, and then they will point out that genuine experience. It's moved a long way away from that into much more of a, you know, like a hotel, but not a hotel. It's interesting that a lot of what ecotourism in places like Ghana, that's what they do. You know, you go and stay as the guest in someone's village, and the idea is that you get to know a little more of what the country is really like than you would if you stayed on a beach. But that we tend to think of that as happening in sort of poorer countries and more remote locations. But I mean, why not have it in, you know, somewhere like Oslo or Munich?
And then from a developer point of view, Jonathan, if hotels are to reflect all that's been said around the table and to be fully connected with the city, they're still treated, still viewed, aren't they, as something a little bit distinct. You know, you may have a mixed-use development, you'll talk about the residential offer and the offices offer and perhaps the retail offer, and then the hotel sometimes feels like an addition.
Neglected.
Yeah. Neglected, or maybe a late addition.
Yeah, it's the... I think that's reflective of a common misunderstanding of the benefits that visitor accommodation brings to a place. It's also a reflection of the extent to which land, by virtue of being finite and regulated, is a scarce resource. And when people bring forward proposals for new visitor accommodation, invariably it's in the mix. It's intentional, but it's also viewed as something which competes for that land with homes and jobs, and you know, things which are seen to have perhaps more easily understandable and recognised benefits. But if you actually look at the visitor sector, research by UK Hospitality showed not too long ago that sector and the wider ecosystem that supports it, from linen and food provision and everything else, makes the hospitality sector in the UK the third largest employer, and with a contribution of just under 10% of GVA to our national economy. So it's a big player. And I think if you then look at the way the industry is changing, the extent to which, and this is perhaps more for James, but design can open up and unlock sites that haven't been considered previously, but also the extent to which we can look increasingly at the uses within a hotel. And the point I made before is more fragmented and distinct. So you've got the income production from the rooms, and also the income production, you could potentially view them as almost standalone businesses, from the other uses around gym, bars, restaurants and things like this. We could start to see hotels as a much more valuable and meaningful part of city making, and much more responsive to the city. And in turn, when we live in an age where the death of the high street as a topic has been done to death, actually, you know, these are things that bring people into town centres. They drive footfall, which supports local businesses, because you do actually go and have Tony was saying, you do actually go and have a coffee nearby. You do actually go to a local restaurant. You don't, you know, they are outward looking. And so I think perhaps what's been missing is people to stand outside of the hotels and hospitality sector to actually stand up for visitor accommodation and to shout about the real benefits that it does bring in terms of placemaking and economy. And also, just sort of very quickly, more the sort of softer benefits, because with more people living in city centres, in their two-bed flat, what happens at Christmas when your mum or dad comes to stay? I suspect for many people, they will end up in the Travelodge or the Premier Inn or the Block or whatever it is, at might be at the end of the road. So there is a social function from visitor accommodation as well, outside of just the global tourist sector.
And what about Richard's point earlier that it may work for Margate, but will it work for Bridlington?
Well, I'm not an expert on Margate nor Bridlington, so
take it thematically rather than specifically.
Without wanting to sound like a free marketeer, I think the market will respond. The people will seek to provide a product that's appropriate to the requirements of people there, because you're looking at an income producing business in effect that locks you in for a prolonged period of time. So you have to understand where the demand is and then seek to respond to that.
I think what it is that you're absolutely right. And I think historically, you might look at hotel design as being made kind of off-site or designed off-site, and then it just gets designed, and there you go, there's another one there's another one. Actually, I think what hotel operators are doing now, as designers, we should be looking at it in a more bespoke way. So what actually does that town need? So I think a lot of boroughs at the moment, like Southwark, I chaired an event in NLA recently, and they're actually requiring 10% of hotel space to be a community asset, which I think is they're trying to grapple with the fact that the hotel accommodation is increasing. They're trying to say, okay, how do we, from a policy perspective, give back? And I think the enthusiasm's there from hotel operators, and I think more and more the ground floor area should be treated as something slightly different in each zone. You know, what do they actually need on that high street? Is it just a place that's not very welcoming, or it's just literally to the hotel? Or actually, let's look a bit more outwardly in terms of our design and our use. And what else can we offer? Can we give back to the community? Like a lot of sort of really great public space, you know, public house or libraries, or, you know, how do we kind of give back to the local schools, semi-public event space? You know, actually, I think the hotels are having to become more transient, or they should be. But that might not work for Bridlington, or it might work perfectly for a high street in North London or something. So I think we've just got to look at it more holistically, and then look specifically what does that town actually need.
I think we should move on from Bridlington. Richard?
Well, how about Stockton then? We're doing work with the Ministry on the High Streets Task Force, and Stockton won, I can't remember which award it was, but, you know, very exciting. Stockton on Tees, very exciting developments on High Street. But one of the things that they've really succeeded with is a series of festival isn't necessarily the right word, but, you know, there are events. So in June, there's a famous muscle car sort of parade. That's one of the things in their calendar. And this is both an opportunity and a problem, because from the hospitality industry, you know, everyone wants to go to Stockton on, you know, for two nights in June. But then what happens? And then they have another successful thing in another month. But keeping that going, some of the fascinating work that's been done somewhere like Stockport has been around the idea that you know, you have Foodie Friday. I think it's every once a month and every Friday. But there again, these could end up creating peaks and troughs in demand, which is going to be very difficult for an operator to deal with. But that seems to be one of the most successful ways in which places are putting themselves on the map, is by this sort of festival event kind of plan the whole year at once thing.
I guess it's maybe it's a nicer problem to have, to keep up that momentum rather than grab attention, which must be very much harder. And James, I just wanted to come back to you on a point around sustainability, actually, and the role that hotels can play there, because the sustainability challenge facing real estate is considerable, and it's going to be most considerable. It is most considerable in the embedded carbon in existing buildings and how we can reuse those. That's something that is usually celebrated in hotels. Yeah. So it can lead from the front here, can it?
Definitely. I think a lot of operators now are looking at most hotels are sort of as a minimum BREEAM very good. A lot of them now are BREEAM outstanding, but I think that's just looking at the carbon element. You've really got to, what hotels are brilliant at is looking at refurbishment. So instead of new build all the time, actually they fit perfectly in old 60s office blocks, perfect conversion, because floor to ceiling heights are quite low, where modern office developments are looking at 2.8, 2.9, 3 meter clear high generally. So I think that it's managed to fill a really, really good, but certainly we've done quite a few conversions in Westminster, and it's great because, you know, you look at the 2.4 high ceiling. So in that sense, it's very good because you're looking at reusing. I think where we've just got to be careful with sort of the method of building when you're looking at like a METSEC frame. In the future, is that you can't actually adapt them very well. So that's the flip side. Very fast to build, but actually, how do you really sort of convert an off-site modular build? So, but I think it's a 24/7 operation, isn't it? A hotel, so, you know, it should be looking to reduce its carbon footprint. I think a lot of hotel operators are, actually. So, yeah.
Okay, we've not got long left, but just before I move on to a last question, Tony, you wanted to come in there.
Yes, something we spoke about initially, which was the star system, and this quality of accommodation. And I wonder if we're now more at a price point for accommodation, because we didn't speak about price point, and that's a very important thing in terms of the viability of the whole scheme. So I wonder, and this goes back to the various social media commentary you get on accommodation, if that has now brought the levels up, or at least the ones which don't satisfy people get dropped off and people don't use them. And so then the competition is really about the price point at which you can access. But that's a critical part of whether something gets built, whether it gets refurbished. You wonder to what extent that's spread out throughout all of the cities we're talking about. I would like to sort of reiterate Jonathan's point about the World Tourism Organization in terms of its tourism as a distributor of wealth to countries which typically don't share in the uplift in economic growth. But tourism is, by the World Tourism Organization, the UN organization, is a very good distributor of wealth in this way. So it's to be encouraged, but in a sustainable way, I suppose, is the cliche.
Okay, I did think you were going to make that sustainability point around the star system, actually, whether that the star system should be more reflective of the, you know, embedded or ongoing sustainability of the hotel itself. But we'll have to leave that. One last question. We are talking about the future of hotels in the city and how hotels can, I suppose, contribute more to the city, and the sector can benefit as well. And I just wonder what we've talked about so many things today. I wonder what each of you would see as a priority if that is going to be a successful outcome. Richard, I'll start with you.
Well, from a regulatory point of view, to sort out really this question of, you know, do we want homes to be used as hotels, and then
do you think,
and then also what does that mean for the demand for the construction of actual hotels, because it's a very cloudy field at the moment with the actual product being satisfied both through the use of flats and through the use of actually purpose-built or refurbished hotels.
And are you agnostic on that point? You just want resolution, or do you feel strongly one way or the other?
Not totally agnostic, because we will be hearing, probably already have heard this morning, around the government's desire to get the right number of homes built, and local authorities in this country having to assess the housing need. Well, it's very difficult to do that if your housing need is bleeding away to some other purpose. And how would you work out how many houses you need if you end up finding in certain places a big chunk is bleeding out towards short stay accommodation, which it wasn't designed specifically for?
Okay, thank you. And Tony, what would be your priority if a successful hotel sector is going to contribute to successful cities?
Well, I think you really have to see them as their investment assets, their private investment assets. They're also city assets, and they need to function to satisfy both requirements. And James probably suggested a linkage there where some of these hotels will provide some community facilities, which is an interesting evolution of the role of a hotel.
James?
Yeah, for me, the big one is community. I think if a hotel at the moment is acts as an enabler to a city, and I think what we've tried to do over the last year or so is try and have these conversations, because I don't think it's talked about enough. So I think this is a perfect platform for have industry leaders to actually talk up hotels, as Jonathan said earlier. So I think community is the biggest one, and I think over the next 10 years you're going to see hotels provide a real role in that in the city.
Thank you. Jonathan?
I think we need to anticipate the requirements properly. Not least, we're in London today's requirement for 200 million nights additional to 2041 with 60,000 rooms. But I think across the country, we should be actively and proactively trying to understand the changes that are afoot and to plan properly for that. I think we need to recognise the extent to which things are in a state of flux at the moment. We've talked a bit about Airbnb and the impact on traditional housing stock. actually demand for that kind of product is driving a whole new asset class in institutional grade, large scale service departments. So actually we need to recognize the shifts that are occurring. And I think we need to celebrate the benefits that hotel and visitor accommodation can have, and actually ensure that that is recognised properly as part of that process.
And do you think too that given the San Francisco experience, the Barcelona experience, London needs to be a bit more outward looking if it's to maintain its success?
I think we all need, it's about management for me ultimately. I think it's about just honest recognition of the upsides, mitigating or celebrating the upsides and mitigating any downsides.
Okay, we're out of time, I'm afraid, but thank you all for coming into the studio today. Thank you all for listening, and indeed thank you to everyone who's listened this week and to all of our partners who've helped make this week possible. Enjoy the rest of MIPIM week, and thanks again.